So, good morning everyone. Welcome to the first lecture on virtual machines. My name is Stefan Schulze-Frielinghaus, and today I will give this lecture. Since Professor Helmut Seidel is on a business trip, so next week he will be back. So today I will do the lecture, and before we actually dive into virtual machines, we will have a look at some organizational stuff. This lecture will start at 10 o'clock on Monday, and you also have a lecture on Thursday. Tuesday. Tuesday, it's Tuesday. And we will have a tutorial. So for this week, there will be no tutorial, but starting on the next week, we will have a tutorial where we will do some exercises and play around with abstract machines. And we will hand out assignments each week, which you should solve at home, which is, I guess, kind of important for the exam. Doing this homework. And until now, we haven't decided if we will give you a bonus for the homeworks or if we will hand out a project. So this is something we will decide during this week, and then we will let you know how we deal with that. So this means a bonus. Once you pass the exam, you will get an 03 or 04 bonus on your final mark. Okay, so that's the thing about the tutorials. I think you are all interested in virtual machines or abstract machines. Another thing I would like to mention here is that we also have other lectures which play around with compiler technologies. So, especially this course called Compiler Construction. So if you really want to develop your own compiler, then this might be a lecture you're interested to. Or during the winter terms, we also have other lectures like programming languages where you play around with different styles of programming languages. And then we have another course called Program Optimization where you will learn how you can systematically optimize a program. Okay, so let's start, or do you have questions so far about the organizational stuff? Yeah. The registration, you actually just have to enroll in Toom Online for this course, and then you get automatically registered into Moodle for that. No, there's nothing special. Yes, we will announce when the tutorials will take place, also during this week. And then just drop by into these tutorials. The exam date, good question. I will look that up. I don't have it in mind right now. Yeah? Yes, the lecture courses are recorded and they are made online, available. Further questions? Okay. Then we will have a look at virtual machines. So first of all, we will have a look at the principle of interpretation. So what does this mean? Well, you have your program. So this is typically in some language written. So you have your source code there. And then you have some input. Well, this input might be coming in from a file or a network input, or you have user input typed into some keyboard or something like that. And then you put this into an interpreter, and the interpreter then interprets the program together with the input and produces some output. So this is the principal idea of interpretation. The advantage of this is that, for this input program, you don't have to pre-compile it before, first. So we can skip this. That means we have more or less no startup time. Of course, the startup time for the interpreter, but this is typically so fast that you don't really realize that there is some startup time. The disadvantage is here that we don't have any evaluation of the source code program beforehand, before we actually execute it. That means we cannot optimize it beforehand. So this might result then in slower execution speeds. So here we might lose something, but again, we have this advantage that we have more or less no startup time. Whereas on the other hand, the principle of compilation, there, well, we again have our input program, again written in some source language. Then we feed it into the compiler, and the compiler then produces some code as an output. So this is typically code for your actual machine hardware, like x86 instruction code. And then you take, again, your input and feed it into the, or execute the actual code, so the binary, which will then produce the output. So here, in contrast to the interpreter, we have two phases, namely, a compilation phase, where we translate the source code program into this machine code, and then we execute this machine code. And here again, we have the possibility to optimize our source code program at compile time. Here it is again written that this pre-processing, this compilation of the source code program has the advantage that we might generate efficient access to these to some values of program variables, and of course that we have the possibility to globally transform the program in order to get an increased execution speed. However, this two-phase step also has the disadvantage that the compilation takes time. And depending on how aggressively you want to optimize, compilation can be quite an overhead, especially if you develop your program iteratively. That means you change something, you compile it, test it, then again you might found a bug or something like that, you again have to recompile it, and so forth. So this may take some time. That advantage, of course, is if you then have some production-ready code, so to speak, then you might want to optimize it very aggressively in order to get an efficient speed up. So how is a compiler designed, or how is the structure of a compiler? Well, again, you take your input program written in some source language like C, Java, or something like that, and put it into the compiler, and the compiler then has as a front end, it takes this source program and produces as an output an internal representation of this program, and this is often called the syntax tree, and there you have variances like abstract syntax tree or concrete syntax tree, or even other representations like and control flow graph or something like that. And then, starting from such an internal representation, you perform some optimizations. Like, again, if you want to do some control flow analysis, you'll probably want to do this on a control flow graph. And these optimizations, if you apply them to this internal representation, you again get something in this internal representation. And finally, if you have done all these optimizations, you will generate code. And this will be something which the target machine understands, so something like x86 instructions. Okay, so this is how a compiler is typically designed. And why do we do this? Well, of course, we want to speed up the program. I mean, otherwise, we could skip the compiler part and directly interpret the program. Here, if you compile it, you might efficiently select instructions, and that means instructions which are equivalent. So, for example, if you want to set a register, you want to assign it the value 0, you can either do this by, saving the number 0 into this register, or are there other possibilities? Can you think of something which might be a little bit more efficient depending on the architecture? So the task is we want to zero a register. And I guess the obvious thing is to write the constant 0 into it. Sorry? Dereference it? Well, I mean, on the hardware level, you often don't know what a reference is. So this is something high level, like in a C language.
There may be some key register instruction that already writes zeros in the register.
Yeah. We want to round the register.
Put it down the register.
What do you mean with putting down? Yeah. Okay, this is then something like this special clear instruction, or, another instruction what you often see in compilers is that they do an XOR with the register itself. Then you also clear it, and this XOR instruction is typically faster than saving the constant 0 into this register. So this means this is something you don't want to do as a programmer. You don't want to write into your code that the variable x is initialized with x or x. But what you want to do is you want to write x equals 0 because this is more human readable and you know what you want to do. But the compiler should be somehow clever and know what instruction is equivalent and what instruction might be faster than the other. So this is this part of instruction selection. And then... we are also faced with the problem of register allocation. So, on a typical Intel architecture, you have, I don't remember by heart, but something around 30 to 40 general purpose registers, and you often have more variables than that, so in total in the program, of course. And then you have to efficiently allocate these registers. And, of course, another subtask is this instruction scheduling. So sometimes you know that instructions are independent of each other, and it might be more efficient to schedule an instruction before another instruction in order to keep this pipeline filled. Okay, yeah, and all this together then... we might optimize then our code as much as possible. And therefore this compilation is useful. And if we have a look at modern compilers, how do they look like? Well, they often have this, again, from the front end, you generate some intermediate representation, and then you have this phase of already of code generation, but then you produce a code of an abstract machine. And ongoing from this abstract machine, you can then either decide, so we have again this abstract machine code, you can either decide that you finally compile this into this concrete machine code, or what you also can do is you can interpret this abstract machine code together with the input in order to get our output. So this is another idea of how nowadays these machines are designed. And, well, do you have an idea of, how did you face this problem? So can you think of a programming language where you already got used to such a design?
Java.
Yeah, exactly. So there you have your compiler. You generate this abstract machine code, which is, well, from Java to this Java virtual machine instructions. And then you can either design to compile it into x86 code, or typically you interpret it. Or even on the fly, you decide some Java virtual machine instructions I just interpret, and some, well, I know that I already executed it 10,000 of times, so then I decide to compile it on the fly. Okay. So what is then a virtual machine good for? Well, as an architecture, we often have an idealized architecture. So that means, well, maybe we don't want to deal beforehand with register allocation, so we might think of a machine which has infinitely many registers. So this is the sense you should get when we think about idealized architecture, and that we have a simple code generation for these architectures, and of course, well, that they can be easily implemented on real hardware, so these instructions should be somehow sensible to the real world. And, well, if you have such a virtual machine with these properties, then the advantage of that is that you can simply port this compiler then to a new architecture. So, again, if you think of the Java virtual machine, you already know the instructions. We have this idealized architecture, and if you want to port it, let's say, from the Intel architecture to PowerPC, then it's not that much of a burden than if you think of writing a compiler for C, which translates directly into Intel instructions, and then you want to port this compiler into another architecture, and you have no intermediate layer, or if you haven't dealt or thought about this problem beforehand, then this is a real burden to do. And, well, of course, the modularization makes, of course, the compiler easier to modify and to adapt to new instructions. So again, here you can think of the Java virtual machine where something like the Lambda instructions have been introduced. You might have to tweak here and there the virtual machine, but the underlying code generation or interpreter, you don't really have to touch. And the translation of these program constructs is separated from the exploration of this real architectural features. Okay, so what virtual or sometimes also called abstract machines are around there? And I don't know if it is really the very first one, but for Pascal, there was this P machine around, and, well, yeah, you see a list of some programming languages here with the corresponding virtual machine. Who has actually programmed in Prolog so far? Who has experience with that? Just one? Okay. Let's see in a second. Well, yeah, of course, here are some other languages like SML or Java you probably already heard of. Well, Smalltalk was more or less the first object-oriented programming language. Yeah. So, well, in this course, we will have a look at some programming languages, and we will develop an virtual machine for them. So first, we will have a look at the C programming language, and we will develop a virtual machine called CIMA for that. And, well, once we have something for C, so for an imperative programming language, then we might extend it to something object-oriented. So this is what we then call the C++. Well, why C++? C++ is a very huge beast, which is, too hard to tackle in the first place. So we will just have a look at some features of C++ and develop, therefore, a virtual machine called OMA. And, well, yeah, after we have a look at this C programming language, we will have a look at a pure functional language and where we will develop an virtual machine called MAMA. And then, well, at least you will have some experience there. We will have a look at Prolog-based programming language, this PROL. Again, we don't have a look at full Prolog, not the full Prolog, but more or less the full Prolog, which is then called PROL. And for that, we also will develop a virtual machine called Vim. And then finally, if we still have some time in this course, we will have a look at some multi-threaded C, where we will then extend our CIMA with concurrent instructions. Okay, so this is what we want to do. And now we start with this translation of a C source program. So what is the architecture then of our virtual machine CIMA? For each virtual machine, we need somehow a set of instructions. And these instructions are then executed in this virtual hardware. So this is what our interpreter is then for. And this virtual hardware, it can be viewed as a set of data instructions, data structures, which the instructions then access and operate on. And of course, these data structures, they are managed by the runtime system, so we don't want to take care of that, but our runtime system should deal with that. So first of all, what we need is a data store. And, well, this data store is organized as a stack. It means we have here our data store S, and we can allocate new cells in that stack. Yeah, and of course, well, a stack is last in, first out discipline. And in order to deal with this stack, we have, well, you can think of in this inside in this virtual machine of a variable called stack pointer, this SP, or, well, the virtual machine will then take this variable on the concrete machine as has typically a register for that, sometimes called SP. I guess this is the case in PowerPC architectures. I don't know how it's done in Intel architecture, but they also have typically a dedicated register for the stack pointer. Yeah, so this is this SP thing. And, well, also, well, we already said that C++ is too hard to deal with, so we have to somehow simplify it. And also, here in C, we don't develop a virtual machine for full C, but we will simplify it in the sense that we simplify it such that all the data fits into one word or into one cell in our stack. So again, if we think of the real world where we have Intel instructions, let's say we have a 32-bit architecture, then our data word is 32 bits, and we might only access the lower byte of it. So this is, of course, possible in the real world, and you can assign values to that lower byte only and keep the rest as it is, but in our case, everything will be one word. I guess this is a sensible simplification and makes it drastically easier to deal with this C code. Yeah, we have a data store where we store our data. And then what else do we need? We need a code store where our instructions are stored in. And yeah, this code store we denote by this C. Yeah, and this code store then, as the name already implies, our translated instructions are stored in there. And again, we assume that each cell, each field in this code store can store exactly one virtual machine instruction. Is this actually sensible, or can you think of architectures where you have different lengths of instructions? Exactly. So, before, well, these RISC instruction sets, these are typically, or I'm not aware of any RISC instruction set where the length of these instructions have different size. But for example, as you already mentioned, this Intel instruction set, this is CISC, and there an instruction might have a different length. And, well, the benefit of that is that you might produce smaller code sometimes if you only have a small instruction, but the burden of that is that you have to somehow load just a byte or two byte. Then you have to interpret that byte, and in order to find out if you have to load another byte in order to get the full instruction out of it. So here, again, as a simplification, we assume that each instruction fits exactly into one field. And we need, something similar to a stack pointer. We need a pointer into this code store in order to remember which instruction we have to execute next. And this is done by this program counter PC. So this points into the store. And initially we assume that this pointer has the address 0. So that means that our first instruction we want to execute is at this C0. Okay, so how can we then execute our program? There we assume that we have special instruction register, IR, where we load our next instruction in and then we execute it. So that means, basically you can think of something like this while loop where we just fetch our next instruction out of our code store where the actual code pointer is pointing to. We save this into this instruction register. Then we increase the code pointer, pointing then to the next instruction. And we call finally our execute function with the argument of this instruction register. So this is more or less how this virtual machine will then execute the instructions. So now let's dive into it. And let's face this problem of evaluating an expression. And we now are given with this expression, and we have to generate code for that. And first, is it sensible actually to generate code for this? If we have a look at this expression, so what would a compiler do, or a sensible compiler, or a clever compiler do, instead of an interpreter? Exactly. So actually for that example, it wouldn't make sense to get instructions for these expressions. But if you know at compile time or statically, if you know all the operands are known, then you can actually just evaluate that expression. But just for an example here, we will deal with generating code for this expression. And how do we do this? Well, we will generate a sequence of these instructions. And what do these instructions do? Well, they have to determine the value of these sub-expressions in order to get the whole expression. And well, so far we only had our stack, so we have to push the results of these instructions when they are executed. The results are then saved in this stack. So the general idea is then first to compute these values for all sub-expressions. Each sub-expression saves its value on top of the stack, and then we apply this operator. So this means here we would first emit code for this left-hand side of this multiplication. And that itself, this sub-expression, would generate code for this addition. So we would first then generate code for this constant 1, then for this constant 7, and then we apply the operator, this addition, which would save the result 8 on top of the stack. And then again, we generate code for this right-hand side of this expression, so it's this 3, push that on top of the stack, again, apply the operator, and get the final result. So this is the general idea. If we want to do this, we have to deal with constants, and here we have this special instruction called load constant, and for an arbitrary constant q. Again, we assume that this constant fits into one cell into our stack. And how is this instruction actually implemented? Well, we have our initial stack, so this is given here. This stack is increased by one cell, so we put some cell on top of that. And that cell is then initialized with this constant q. this is put in there. And so this is then our first virtual machine instruction, load C, load constant, and the respective constant then. Okay, so let's come back to our example where we had this problem of multiplication. There, well, in contrast to this load constant, it does not consume any stack cell. So this is an instruction which only adds something to the stack, but it does not consume anything from the stack. Whereas for this instruction mul, this multiplication, well, what does it do? It takes the topmost two stack cells, pops them, and does a multiplication of them. So, and the result is then again put on top of the stack. So again, the difference here is that it consumes or it expects its arguments on top of the stack. And yeah, you can easily come up with all these binary operators like addition, subtraction, division, modulo, and also these logical operators like AND, OR, XOR, and so forth. They all operate in the same way. That means they expect their two arguments on top of the stack, and their result will be also then on top of the stack. And similarly, also for unary operators like NOT or negation. Yeah. And similarly, also this Boolean comparison operators, equal, not equal, lower, lower equal, and so forth. They all operate in the same way. Yeah, here's even an example. So, first of all, our convention is that 0 represents the Boolean truth value false, and all other integers represent true. So also minus 42 is true. Yeah, I mean, this is like in almost all real architectures. Yeah, and lower equal will also consume two arguments on top of the stack, and it will produce a 1 if it's true and a 0 otherwise. Yeah, and similar, these unary operators. I guess this is nothing special. So then let's have a look. How does our stack actually look like? For representation purposes, we don't actually say how much is in this stack. If there are n stack cells, we don't care. So for representation purposes, when we will define these instructions, you will always see something like that. The stack also starts at the address 0 and increases. So this is also something where you might wonder, well, if we have a look at the Intel architecture and how operating systems implement stacks there, they typically start at the highest address and their stack pointer decreases then. Well, for this simplification here in our virtual machine, we think that our stack increases. And then for representation purposes, these new stack cells are then here introduced like that. So we put something on top of the stack. This is done, well, if we have a look at this example, for if we want to produce code for this 1 plus 7, we first load the constant 1. So then this number 1 is pushed on top of the stack. This is the left-hand side of the expression. Then we deal with the right-hand side of this expression. So we do a load constant 7. So then we finally put this 7 on top of this 1, which we have done, which we have pushed before on top of the stack, and then we can execute the actual arithmetic operator here, this addition. This will consume both operands. That means it pops them from the stack and pushes then again the result, which is this 8 on top of the stack. Okay, throughout the course, we will also have to deal with variables, and we will allocate stack cells for these variables in our stack, and we might dedicate with a certain stack cell a variable. So that means here, for example, this X might be at this address of this stack. This is 42. We somehow have to remember that this variable X is stored at this address 42, and this we will do in this environment which we call row. This is then our address environment, and so how does it look like then? We have our row. Well, we then have these mappings of these variables, and in this small example, if we say that variable X starts at the address 42, then we know that this variable Y has to start at 33 and so on, because we have an increasing stack, and again we assume that each stack cell content has the length of 1. Okay, so this is what we have this address environment for. And well, now let's have a look at a slightly more complicated assignment or expression here. So here we have an expression where we assign the value y plus 1 into this variable x. And there we first note that we have somewhat a different notion of accessing a value, an variable. Well, sometimes we are interested in this L value and R value. So what is an L value? An L value is actually the address of an variable, whereas the R value is the content of an address. So here, in our small example, we are interested here in the R value of Y, because we want to know what the actual value is inside this variable Y, but we want to save the result into this variable X. That means we are not interested in the value of X, but in the address of X. That means for this variable X, we're interested in the L value, and in order to differentiate between these things, we have an instruction which we call code generation underscore subscript this R for an expression E, or we have a code generation scheme called code L of E for the L value of an expression E. And these, as mentioned before, these code generation schemes, they also take as a parameter this address environment row, where we remember where our variables are stored in. So again, this was this thing where we map our variables to actual addresses. Okay. Something we should note here is that not every expression has an L value. So, here's an example given. This X plus 1, obviously, it only has a R value, but not an L value. So this expression is not stored somewhere. But if we interpret this expression, then of course it has a return value, because each expression has a value. So that means, how do we proceed in our code generation schemes? So We have for all these binary operators, the code generation scheme is as follows, that if we have an expression E1 plus E2, then we first generate code for this expression E1, then we generate code for the second argument, namely this expression E2, and then we execute, or then we emit code for the execution of the actual operator. And this, yeah, the same style holds for all these binary operators, and similar, our code generation scheme for unary operators is as follows, that we first generate code for this expression E, and then we have this virtual machine instruction NEC, which will negate the result, which has been computed by this expression E. Yeah, and again, this is done for all operators in this style. If we emit code for a constant Q, well, we already saw this instruction, and this instruction is then this load constant Q. Similar, if we are interested in the L value of a variable, then what do we do? Well, again, how does our row look like? Our row is a mapping which assigns some values to our variables. This is our row. And there, what we do is we emit this instruction load C, but actually of what content? Well, the content is depending, because this X, this might be sometimes in a different stack cell, and this is what we saved in our environment row. So we first have to look it up. So this row of X, this is something which we do during the phase of emitting this code for our virtual machine, and then this will result into the instruction load constant 42, which is written into our output file, into our intermediate representation, and then might be interpreted by our interpreter. Okay? So then we need an instruction also for not only getting the left hand, so the L value of a variable, but also we are interested in the content behind such a variable, and there we emit or we compute the address of this variable X. This is done by this code L of X, and then we have a special instruction load in our virtual machine. And how is it defined? Well, the load instruction, again, it expects a value on top of the stack, like other instructions we had before, and we assume that this content on top of the stack is actually a pointer or the address of the variable. So in this case here, this is just the pointer to the stack cell containing this 13, and then the instruction load will pop this address, so it will destroy this address here and push the value behind this address on top of the stack. That means, well, if we think of a C instruction, this is something like that. So we save at the current position in the stack, we save the content which is addressed on top of the stack there. So then we already have quite a lot of instructions. So the next thing which we typically want to deal with are then assignments. So how is an assignment done here? Well, we first have to evaluate the right-hand side of an assignment, so we are interested here in code R, so we are interested in the value. Again, here we assume that we produce code R for that thing, so we then produce also the value for this expression E, and we want to save it in this variable X. That means we have to compute the address of X, and this is what we do by code L. And then we have a similar instruction like this load. We also have a store instruction, which will pop the topmost deck cell, where we again assume that there is an address in there where we want to store the value of the second topmost stack cell. So in this case, it's 13. And then, yeah, again, this is then saved in this stack cell. So this is what is depicted here. This topmost stack cell is destroyed, but the value of this expression E, it is still alive here. This is something we should note here. And again, this value is then saved in the address of the topmost stack cell. Okay, so let's have a look at a slightly bigger example in order to get used to this style. So we have an expression here. This expression E is an assignment into X. And there we also have our code environment given here. So how would then code generation produce code for that? So we have code R of this expression E for this environment row. And, well, so this is, again, this is our complete E. So what it does then, it produces code R for this right-hand side. So we have to produce code for this expression. And again, this expression is then evaluated first the left-hand side, so we have to produce code for this variable y. That means here we look it up. What is this variable y? This variable y is saved at address 7, so we have to come up with a load constant 7, and since we are interested in the value behind this address, we have to perform a load. And then afterwards, how does the stack look like? Well, if that was the stack before, then the value of this variable y is saved in there. Then we have to emit code for this right-hand side of this expression. This is this 1. So that means we just have to come up with a load constant 1, which is then pushed on top of the stack. And then finally, we can execute this operator, and this is this sub. So we subtract it. How does it look like then? Well, in this example, we then have this y minus 1. So this is something evaluated during runtime. And then we finally have our value of this expression here on top of the stack. And then we have to come up with this address where this value should be saved in. This is into this variable x. And we look it up. Well, this X is stored at this address 4, so we load this constant 4, and we perform this store, which would then, again, so, well, maybe I was a little bit too fast here, so this is popped from the stack, and then, well, we have this constant 4 here, and the store instruction would again pop this address, this topmost stack cell, resulting then in this stack layout where the value of this right-hand side is still stored on top of the stack because it is an expression. Okay, and since we have to do quite a lot of these load and store instructions, we come up with a shorthand, this load A. This load A should remind you of the load absolute value. So because we have an address here, and this is just a shorthand for load the constant Q and then perform the actual load instruction. And analogous for storing a value, we introduce this shorthand store A in order to abbreviate that a little bit. Okay, so far so good. So we have seen the most basic code generation schemes for expressions. And, well, in C, well, we also have to deal not only with expressions, but we also have statements. That means if whenever we have an expression E, then E semicolon is a statement. That means an statement does not return or does not deliver a value, so we have to somehow destroy this value by the semicolon. And how is it done? Well, the code generation scheme for a statement is now just code, not code R or code L, but code emits then. No? So, if we want to produce a code for this statement E semicolon, we just produce code R of this expression E, and then we have to destroy the value which is left by this expression on top of the stack. And this is done what we do by this pop instruction. This will just pop the topmost stack cell. Okay, so we have an idea how to deal with one statement, but of course C has several statements, consecutive statements we have to deal with. And this is then done, like you probably would expect. If you have one statement following other statements, you first emit code for this very first statement, and then you emit code for the rest of the statements. And, well, code for the empty sequence of statements is then just nothing. So probably what you would expect. So, well, so far we can produce code for our abstract machine, for assignments. We have all these Boolean and unary expressions. But what is missing is control flow. And for that, we introduce a special instruction called jump A, where A is an address in our code store. And how does it look like? Well, again, in our virtual machine, we have this code pointer, this special register called PC. And there, this instruction jump A, it will just set the content of this code pointer to this address A. So this is an unconditional jump. And of course, if we want to deal with control flow, we have to deal with conditional jumps, and this is done by this instruction jump 0 to A. That means whenever we have something which is unequal to 0, we don't perform a jump. And in case, so this means the code pointer is not changed. It's not changed here, but whenever we have a 0 in our on top of the stack, the instruction jump 0 will change the program counter here. And how is this actually implemented? Well, this is implemented like this in our interpreter. So it checks if the topmost stack cell contains a 0, and in that case we assign the address A to this program counter here, and then it consumes the topmost stack cell. So nothing special here. Well, so far, in order to also simplify this and make it easier to generate code, we make use of symbolic jump targets. And these symbolic jump targets are then afterwards translated into absolute addresses. So these symbolic jump targets, they make it easier to generate code. And furthermore, if we don't want to make use of absolute addresses, we might make use of relative addresses, so relative to some base. So this is something we will see onwards. If you want to generate code for functions, there we have, there we might have local variables where we have to deal with, and these are relative to the current stack frame. So here we will then see relative addressing, where so far we only had this load absolute value of an absolute addressing. Okay, so of course, well, what is the advantage here? If we have smaller addresses, well, they typically suffice most of the time. And still important here, if we make use of these relative addresses, then the code becomes relocatable. You can easily shift it around. And maybe you can then exploit some hardware features. If you reallocate this here and there, then this might be a good thing to do. So let's come back to our conditional statements. So if we have a statement like this, what do we have to do? Well, the general idea is that we have to evaluate this expression E. And in case this evaluates to true, then we have to emit, or we have to execute the code for S prime. And then we have to continue after we have executed this S prime. We have to continue with these statements which come afterwards. Or in case this expression evaluates to false, then we have to immediately go on with these statements after this one-sided conditional statement. So how can we generate code for that? Well, again, we have this code S in our address environment row. We are interested in the expression E, so we are interested in the value of it, so therefore code R. And then we emit a conditional jump to this address A in case it evaluates to false. And, well, where is this address A? This address A is after this code for this expression S. So there we want to go on and continue. And otherwise, if this evaluates to true, then we want to first emit code of it, and of course our virtual machine should then execute this code for this S prime there. Okay, and then, well, if we have a one-sided conditional statement, we also want to have a two-sided conditional statement, and this is somewhat analogous. We have this expression E, then we have a statement S1 and a statement S2, and, well, the code generation for that, we first produce code R for this expression E in case this evaluates to false. Well, Then we have to deal with this code here, this S2. That means we actually jump to this label A and execute the code which we produce by this code generation scheme, code S2 of row. And otherwise, if it is not zero, then we are in this true branch. That means we have to emit code for S1. And this is what we actually do over here. So we emit code for the statement S1. But after this code has then been interpreted by our interpreter, we don't want to execute the statement S2, which was given here at this address A, but we want to go on with the code which we actually generate after this if statement. So we need an unconditional jump to this code afterwards. So therefore, we also have a jump instruction here in this true branch. And yeah, again, if we have a look at this, if we have a look at the false branch, we don't have to come up with an unconditional jump because the code afterwards is consecutively put there. So, well, we don't need a jump here. We can leave that out and spare that. Okay, clear so far? Okay. So let's have a look at a small example here. We are given this two-sided conditional statement. We have an address environment given here. So, well, what do? We first evaluate this conditional expression here. So how does it look like? We first come up with code for this X and then code for this Y. That means here we have a load absolute value of the value of this X, and this value, where is this X stored? This is at this constant 4. And similarly, we want to access this variable Y. There also we do this load absolute, and this Y is stored at this address 7. So therefore, we have this load A of 7 here. And then what is the operator? The operator is a strictly greater than. So therefore, we have this greater instruction here. And in case this is not true, then we jump to this label A. So we jump over there. And otherwise, if it is true, then we consecutively here execute these instructions. So in this true branch, we have this assignment here. And again, how do we emit code for an assignment? We first evaluate the right-hand side, then get the address of the left-hand side, and perform a store. So here, we again load our X. So this is the value of X. Then we access our variable Y. We perform a subtraction, and then we store it again into this variable X, and this is done by this store A4, because again the address of this variable X is 4. And then important here, this is a statement, so we have to perform a pop. And then we are done with emitting code for this conditional statement, and we should proceed by these further statements down here, and this is what is done by this jump, by this unconditional jump to this target B, which is the end of this code here. And otherwise, again, this was for the, maybe I should do it in a different color, so this is the code for our true branch, so this was this case. And otherwise, we have to deal with this else branch. And there, we had this conditional jump to this target A. This was this one here, and there again. Let's do it quickly. We get this variable y, we get the value, the code r of this variable x, we perform this subtraction, and then we perform this store at this absolute address 7, because, well, this variable y is saved at address 7, and again, it is a statement, therefore, we have to perform this pop, and then once we have executed all this, or we have generated code for that, we want to go on at this label B, but this is the next label here, so we don't have to come up with an unconditional jump here. And that's it. Okay, do you have questions so far? Was it too fast, or... No, I think that's... Okay, that's fine. Then... Well, in C, we not only have if statements, we also have loops. And here, well, we will have a quick look at how we can emit code for a while loop. So assume we have a statement S, which is equivalent to this while loop, where we have a condition saved in this expression E, and then the loop body is the statement S prime. So what do we do? Well, at the very first thing, what we have to emit is the beginning of the loop. So we have a target where we can jump to. So this address label A we emit first. Then we emit code for this expression E. Again, we evaluate this, the result of this expression E, which we do by this jump 0. And in case this is false, then we are done with this while loop. So we jump at the end of this loop. This is here, this label B. And otherwise, we have to emit code for the loop of the body. And, well, afterwards, once we have done this loop body, we have to unconditionally jump to the loop entry. This is done by this jump to this address A. So that's a while loop. I think nothing special over here. Let's quickly jump to this example. Well, again, we are given here an address environment row here, and we have a while loop given, and we first emit this code label. So this is then our loop entry. Then we need to get the value of this binary expression, and there we want to access this variable A, and this is saved at address 7, so we have this load A of 7. Then we need to emit code for this constant 0. We check if it is greater. If this is not the case, then we are done. So we have this this conditional jump to the very end of the loop. And otherwise, well, we have to emit code for the loop body. And here we have two statements this time. So first, we have to emit code for this first assignment here, and there we access this variable C, and this is at the address 9, so we first are interested in the value behind it, so we have a load A here, then the right-hand side of this expression is a 1, so just a constant, then we perform the addition of them, and we store again the value in this variable C, which was at address 9, and since this is a statement, we have to remove the very last value on top of the stack. And analogous here, for this assignment, I think I don't want to bore you with these details anymore here. So this is then the code for this assignment, and, well, then we are at the very end of this loop, and again we have to jump back to the very beginning where we have to evaluate the loop condition again and decide if we want to do another round in this loop or if we are done. Oof, okay, so far so good. Well, in C we not only have while loops, we also have for loops, but these are somewhat similar to while loops. Well, again, assume we have a statement here, which is a for loop, and well, what do we do here? We first have to emit code for this expression E1. So we have to perform code R for this one here. And since it is a statement, we have to pop the value of that here. So this expression then, well, you already know it. You might have a loop counter in there or something like that where you want to emit code for. And then similar to this while loop, you have the actual loop expression. This is this E2. And this code down here is somewhat similar to this while loop. So we have to first emit code for this loop condition, where we start at this label A. So this is what we had done also for our while loop. Then we had this conditional jump to the exit of the loop, so if we are done or not. And then we emitted code for the loop body. And here, for this for loop, well, we also have to deal with this expression E3. Well, and this is what we emit code for here. At the very end of each loop body, we have to execute this expression E3, so where we might increase our loop counter or something like that, some post conditions here. And again, this is an expression, but we actually expect that it is a statement, so we also have to perform this pop. And then we unconditionally jump back to the loop entry, and this is at this label A. So what you should note here, that in contrast to this while loop, we also had this thing at the very beginning, but this is only executed exactly one time in this while in this for loop. So this is nothing we want to execute several times. Okay, and then again we have this conditional jump if we want to get out of the for loop. Okay, I think for today we are done with that. Do you have questions so far?
Yeah, what was the S prime?
Ah, this S prime. So this is the loop body. This is like for the while loop, we also emitted code for this body of the loop. Okay. Do you have further questions? Yeah.
Do we have scores for the assignments of this course?
We will hand out assignments each week, and you're supposed to solve them at home. And yeah, we will meet once every week. So we don't have a time slot for that right now, but we will announce it also during this week when the tutorials will take place.
And do we have scores for them? You mean, they're marked or not? Or just for practice?
This is what we will decide this week. Either you will get scores for the assignments, or we will hand out projects to you. This is something I didn't mention at all so far. So we have a machine you might play around with. I will put that on Moodle today or tomorrow. This is called the VAM, where all these virtual machines are implemented in and where you can play around a little bit. There you have a nice animation of the stack and see how all these things interact with each other. Yeah, this is where you might test your assignments in order to sanity check them. And yeah, maybe we have enough projects for all of you such that you can extend this virtual abstract machine. Maybe something like that, or we will score your assignment sheets. But nonetheless, if we score them or we don't score them, please do them at home. This is, I would say, really important for the exam because, I mean, these code generation schemes, they somewhat look easy and intuitive, but if you have to do it by hand, then, having done a little bit of practice here and there is kind of important. Yeah. Yes, there is actually a book which Professor Seidel wrote, and this is really similar to the things. That's the book you can read then on your own if you want to. We don't force you. Okay. Further questions? Okay, that's it. Then see you next week. Not tomorrow. Tomorrow there will be no lecture. But next week again, Monday, Tuesday, and so forth, there will be lectures.
I arrived a bit later. Were there other information about the exam or the place when it's going to
be placed? No, we just discussed the things about the tutorial. But this is what I said here right now. Okay? Further questions? Then see you next week.